A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been turning over something since we did triage a while back, and he's pushed it into a corner that most people don't want to look at directly. Pediatric triage. You take the discipline of emergency sorting, the sick versus not sick call, and you bolt it onto a patient population where a huge share can't tell you what's wrong. Some of them can't talk at all. Some of them have six words and a grunt. And the stakes don't drop because the communication does. So his question is really how the people who do this work, emergency pediatric specialists, make those calls when the patient can't hand them the history. What are they actually looking at?
This one lands close to home for me. I spent years in pediatrics, and the triage part was always the part that kept me up at night. Not the complex cases, not the surgeries, not the rare diagnoses. The first thing to sit with is that children aren't small adults in any sense that matters for triage. A child's physiology compensates. They hold their own, they cope, they look okay, right up until the moment they don't.
That's the thing I want to start with, because I think most people assume pediatric triage is just triage where the patient is shorter.
It's structurally different. The first thing is developmental heterogeneity. A 2-year-old and a 14-year-old are both pediatric patients, but they require completely different assessment approaches. Much shorter. And the tools you'd reach for with an adult, the vital signs, the numbers, they're less reliable. A febrile toddler's heart rate and breathing rate can look exactly like early sepsis.
Lying how? That's a strong claim.
A child's cardiovascular system compensates. When a kid starts to get sick, really sick, the body clamps down peripheral blood vessels, shunts blood to the core, and pushes the heart rate up. Blood pressure stays normal. It looks fine on paper. And the child can't, or won't, or says something that means nothing to you. So the discipline built a different instrument. It's called the Pediatric Assessment Triangle. 30 to 60 seconds, no equipment, done from the doorway. Three domains. Appearance, work of breathing, circulation to the skin.
From the doorway. So, before you've touched the child.
Before you've even introduced yourself. You look at how the child is. Are they alert? Are they interacting with the room? Are they consolable? Are they looking at their caregiver? What's their tone, their gaze, their cry? That's the appearance arm, and it's the most sensitive of the three. Then you watch the chest. Is the child using extra muscles to breathe? Are the nostrils flaring? Is there a tracheal tug? And then skin. Color, modeling, pallor.
That's a chilling way to put it. The warning light has been unplugged, so the clinician is flying without the instruments they were trained to trust.
And then school-aged children who can talk but underreport or misreport symptoms because they don't want a needle, or they don't understand what you're asking, or they're just terrified. And here's the part that's easy to miss. A child who's running around the waiting room, eating, drinking, playing, chatting, that child is demonstrating metabolic and cardiorespiratory sufficiency.
Daniel's prompt has three threads, really. The communication challenge of pediatrics, the heightened stakes of urgent care, and the question of what other fields can steal from pediatric emergency specialists. But to answer any of that, we have to sit with the structural problem first. This isn't adult triage with smaller patients and adjusted thresholds. It's a different discipline.
The clinician has to calibrate for that filter in real time. I'd defend that, and the triangle does well. The published numbers put its accuracy at 0.85 to 0.96 for picking out high acuity illness. That's a real instrument. But it has a known weakness. It's a snapshot.
Let's start with the assessment problem. What it actually looks like when you have seconds to sort a child who can't tell you what's wrong.
You assess three things before you ever touch the patient. Appearance, work of breathing, and circulation to the skin. Appearance means muscle tone, eye contact, responsiveness, whether the child is playing or listless. Which is why serial reassessment is non-negotiable. You don't triage a child once. You triage them, then you re-triage them, then you re-triage them again. And the best version of this is something I used to see in practice. Treat and reevaluate. You get a parent who says something is off, but the parent can't articulate what, because the parent is exhausted and scared and not trained to read their own child's physiology.
So what does the triage nurse actually do? Walk me through the first 30 seconds.
The treatment becomes the diagnostic test. And the catch is that the same clinician has to do the reassessment. If a different person sees the child the second time, they don't have the baseline. And it's designed to be used in seconds from across the room with no equipment.
Walk me through the axes. Start with appearance, because that seems like the one that's hardest to define.
Appearance is the big one. It's tone, interactivity, consolability, gaze, cry. Is the child alert and looking around, or is the child limp and staring through you? Is the child crying vigorously, or is the cry weak and high-pitched? More than most people outside the specialty would guess. There's a study out of Flemish primary care, nearly 4,000 children, that looked at something called clinician gut feeling.
So the child's behavior is the vital sign.
And the parents sensed that this illness was different from previous ones, that carried an odds ratio of 36.3. The caregiver is a diagnostic instrument. Before the heart rate climbs, before the blood pressure drops, before the fever spikes, the child looks wrong. And it makes sense. The parent has the baseline. They know what this child looks like at 3 in the morning when things are fine. They know the normal cry versus the wrong cry. The clinicians never met the child.
And the other two axes?
Work of breathing. You're looking at the child's positioning. A kid in respiratory distress will sit forward, tripod, use the neck muscles. You're looking for retractions, the skin pulling in between the ribs or above the collarbone. That's a discipline. You elicit the concern and you weigh it, but you don't get captured by it. The literature is blunt that parents can unintentionally detract from the encounter. They're anxious, they're exhausted, they're fixated on the wrong detail. The skill is in how you ask. Not, is something wrong, which gets you affrighted, yes. But what's different about this compared to the last time he was unwell?
I want to pause on that, because it's a good example of the difference between knowing the mechanism and just memorizing the sign. A grunt sounds like a small thing. Different question, different instrument.
And the same goes for the child who can talk a little. You don't ask, where does it hurt? A 6-year-old will point at whatever they last looked at. You ask, can you show me where it hurts? Or, what were you doing when it started to hurt? Concrete, anchored questions.
So, the whole discipline is built around extracting signal from people who can't give you a clean history. The child can't self-report. The parent is scared. The numbers are misleading. And yet the system works often enough to keep the doors open.
Let me put some numbers on how often it actually gets it right. A cohort study of just over 1 million pediatric emergency visits, 21 Kaiser Permanente emergency departments in Northern California. Published in JAMA Pediatrics a couple years ago. Correct triage in 34.1% of visits, over triage in 58.5%, under triage in 7.4%.
Wait, correct triage one time in three.
One in three. And that's not a knock on the nurses. That's the difficulty of the problem. The system errs massively toward over-triage. Nearly 6 in 10 kids are sorted as sicker than they are. It has pediatric adaptations. ESI assigns a level from 1 to 5, 1 being immediate, 5 being non-urgent. For adults, it leans heavily on vital signs and the patient's complaint. And that's exactly the calibration. But it creates a second-order problem. Over-triage isn't free. It consumes beds, it consumes staff attention, it delays the sick kids.
And the accuracy problem.
ESI pediatric triage accuracy is an active area of study. Under-triage and over-triage both happen. Under-triage is the nightmare. A child who's compensating gets sorted as a 4 or a 5, sits in the waiting room, and crashes. Over-triage is the quieter problem. A child with a viral cough gets sorted as a 2, takes a bed, and the waiting room backs up. Crowding is itself a safety hazard, so the trade-off is asymmetric. Under-triage kills. Over-triage degrades the whole system.
You'd rather have a crowded waiting room of well children than one dead child sent home.
That's the rational error, but the crowding isn't free. It slows everything down, it burns staff, it makes the next under-triage more likely. The discipline is living inside that tension, and the tension isn't theoretical. It plays out every single shift in every busy emergency department.
Let's talk about the parent-reported history. You mentioned the parent is a data source. How does that work in practice? Because the parent is also a mess, right? They're scared, they're sleep-deprived, they're not objective.
The parent is a proxy historian, and the discipline is treating the parent's account as structured data, not anecdote. You ask specific questions. When did the fever start? Has the child been drinking? How many wet diapers today? Is the child acting like himself? The parent may not be able to say what's wrong, but the parent can tell you what's changed. The parent has the baseline. The clinician doesn't.
So the parent is the calibration standard.
The parent is the calibration standard, and the skill is borrowing the caregiver's baseline without being captured by it. Because the parent is also terrified, and the parent's anxiety doesn't map cleanly onto the child's acuity. A panicked parent can bring in a kid with a cold. A calm parent can bring in a kid in early shock. You have to read the parent's report for the signal, and the child's body for the truth.
That's a hard skill. Reading two data streams at once, one of which is emotional and one of which is physiological, and trying to extract signal from both.
The baseline is the thing you don't have. You have to hold both and decide which one to trust. Most of the time, the child's body wins.
There's a concrete example that keeps coming up in the literature. The child who looks just tired. The wrong direction that keeps children alive. The protocol is built around the recognition that the child's behavior is the vital sign that matters most. The tired child is the dangerous child.
And the literature is explicit that a child being discharged and then returning sicker doesn't mean the initial decision was wrong. The disease progressed. The snapshot was accurate at the time it was taken. The quiet child is the one who scares me. A screaming toddler is almost always fine. A limp, silent toddler is the one you carry to the back.
I want to dig into that teaching problem, because it's not obvious. Why is it hard to teach someone to be scared of a quiet child?
More than 96% of the 30 million plus annual pediatric emergency visits in the States end in discharge home. The serious bacterial infection rate in children over 3 months presenting to a children's emergency department is under 7%. You're playing a game where almost everyone is fine.
Which is what makes the discipline so strange. The base rate protects you. You could guess well and be right almost every time. But the times you're wrong are catastrophic. So the skill isn't in being right. It's in knowing when you can't tell.
And that's where gut feeling earns its keep. The clinician's intuition that something is off, even when the assessment says otherwise, is a validated signal. A likelihood ratio of 25.5. That's not a hunch. That's a pattern matching engine running on thousands of prior encounters. The problem is that evidence-based medicine taught a generation of clinicians to distrust it.
The tension between the guideline and the gestalt.
And the honest answer is that both are valid. The numbers, the symptoms, the signs, and the global gut feel. None of them alone is sufficient. The guideline is simplistic by design. It has to be. It can't capture the intangible elements. But the intangible elements are real. The skill is holding both at once. The child who was sent home and didn't come back. That asymmetry shapes the entire approach. It's why over-triage is the default. It's why the gut feeling gets taken seriously even when the numbers look fine.
The specialists Daniel is asking about are often working in systems that were designed around adults.
You watch the face for grimacing, the legs for drawing up or kicking, the body for stillness or restlessness, the cry for intensity, and whether the child can be consoled. It requires a trained observer, but it's reliable. And there's a revised version for children with cognitive impairment, because the standard scale assumes a neurotypical baseline.
And for the truly non-communicating child, that's actually where I wanted to go next. What does this tell us about expertise in general? Because pediatric triage is a domain where the most important information is often the least direct.
The person who knows what this child's normal cry sounds like.
So the caregiver isn't just a translator. They're the calibration standard.
In a very real sense, yes. The parent is the instrument you use to interpret the child. And the discipline is in knowing when to trust that instrument and when to override it. And that's the tension with the push toward standardization and protocolization. The protocols are good. They catch the obvious cases, they reduce variability, they make the system safer for the average patient.
What can other disciplines learn from this? Daniel asked that directly, and I want to give it real weight. Because the temptation is to say, well, my field doesn't deal with life and death, so this doesn't apply. But I think that's a cop-out.
The parent is probably wrong. You reassure and observe. The hard cases are the ones where the parent says something is wrong and the child looks fine. Because the parent might be seeing the early edge of decompensation that the triangle can't catch yet.
The before picture.
And you don't have it. So you take the parent seriously, you observe, you re-triage, you buy time. Time is the diagnostic tool you use when you don't know. The studies show a statistically significant association between gut feeling and serious illness, with the strength varying depending on the study design and the population. Because deciding right now, with a child who can't talk and numbers that lie, is how you get the 7.4% under triage. The system that does this well is the system that can wait.
So it's not that the clinician's intuition is better than the numbers. It's that the intuition is picking up something the numbers aren't measuring.
That's the right way to think about it. The numbers measure what they measure. Heart rate, respiratory rate, oxygen saturation, temperature. The intuition is measuring something else. The pattern of the whole child. The way all the pieces fit together. And sometimes that pattern is wrong. But it's wrong less often than you'd expect if it were just noise. The behavior and activity model is the most portable piece. A person who's up, eating, interacting, that person is demonstrating physiological reserve.
Fourth, the proxy historian.
The parent as structured data source. When the person can't tell you what's wrong, you find the person who knows them best, and you ask that person structured questions. That's the DART version of it, and it's why the appearance arm of the triangle is the most sensitive. A child who's floppy, who won't engage, who has a blank stare, that child is in trouble even if every number on the chart is normal.
So what does the specialist actually do in the first 60 seconds? Walk me through it. The lesson is less. Install a triage protocol in your startup, and more. When self-report is unreliable, observation and structured proxies beat asking harder.
Is the parent anxious in the way all parents are anxious? Or is the parent anxious in the way that means something? Then you approach. You talk to the child, even if the child can't talk back. You watch the response. You touch the child. You feel the skin, the temperature, the capillary refill. You listen to the chest. You count the respiratory rate yourself because the machine's number is often wrong in a moving child. Then you ask the parent the question. What's different this time?
And then you decide.
And then you decide. Sick, not sick, or watch. And if it's watch, you set a timer.
The timer is the part most people don't see.
The timer is the discipline. The decision isn't the end. It's the beginning of the next observation. And she was right more often than the protocol. The hardest part of my job wasn't the triage decisions. It was managing the parents. They were often more panicked than the child. It gets harder. The national data shows children in general emergency departments are more likely to be mistriaged than children in pediatric emergency departments. Adjusted odds ratio 1.29.
She kept a notebook.
A personal notebook. Not an official log. She wrote down patterns she noticed. Kids who won't make eye contact with the parent are sicker than kids who won't make eye contact with me. I don't know if that's true. She believed it. And she was right more often than the protocol.
The protocol was written down afterward, by people trying to teach what Dolores already knew.
That's what it looked like to me. I sat at that desk for a year and a half. I saw a lot of kids come through. The ones Dolores pulled to the front were the ones who needed it. I never saw her wrong in a way that mattered.
The tacit knowledge that never makes it into the formal protocol. That's the thing I can't stop thinking about. The PAT is an attempt to codify what Dolores did by instinct, but the codification is incomplete. The notebook had the patterns that didn't fit the framework. Eye contact with the parent versus eye contact with the stranger. That's a specific granular observation. It's not in any protocol, and it probably saved lives.
The field knows this. The protocols are necessary but insufficient. The tacit knowledge does the real work in hard cases, and the tacit knowledge walks out the door when Dolores retires.
There's no easy way to capture it. You can't write a protocol for every pattern. The patterns are too many, too contextual, too dependent on the specific nurse's experience. The notebook is the closest thing to a capture mechanism, and it's personal, not institutional.
The institutions that do this well have some way of transferring that tacit knowledge. Mentorship, shadowing, paired shifts. But that's slow, and it doesn't scale. The alternative is to accept that the tacit knowledge is a scarce resource and build systems that don't depend on it as much. But that's a different kind of investment, and most places haven't made it.
The single most common wrong belief about pediatric triage is that it's adult triage with smaller patients and adjusted vital sign thresholds.
It's not. The primary data source is gone. The physiology of compensation means the standard thresholds are late, and the entire discipline is built around reading behavior and borrowing the parent's baseline. The protocols are the scaffolding. The intuition is the building. And you can't have the building without the scaffolding, but the scaffolding isn't the point.
What about the child who can talk a little? The barely verbal? The 3-year-old with 30 words? How do you use that? If pediatric triage depends this heavily on individual judgment, and most emergency departments aren't fully pediatric ready, then the safety margin is thinner than anyone wants to admit. The research on ESI pediatric accuracy is ongoing, and the readiness gap is a known problem. The jump test.
It's a real thing in pediatric abdominal assessment. A child with appendicitis won't jump. A child with gas might. It's crude, but it's a cheap way to get at peritonitis without a scan.
The discipline is full of these little behavioral probes. The smile, the jump, the consolability check. All of them are ways of extracting a lab value from a child who can't give you one. The lesson about structured observation, about behavior as data, about asymmetric error costs, about proxy historians, those apply anywhere the primary data source is unreliable. Which is a lot more places than we like to admit.
The quiet child in the waiting room isn't just a pediatric problem. It's a general problem. The signal is there. You just have to know how to look.
Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com, and if you have a question you want us to dig into, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com.
Doing what?
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.